We are holding on cooked bays on the bays, 9 lines from the bottom. So we learned yesterday about the whole situation where you send somebody to buy, for example, wheat, and instead he buys barley, and we discussed the pros and cons of whether that produce that he ended up buying is considered to be the property of the bala boss, of the one who gave him the money, in which case, if there's a gain in it, then he shares in the gain, or is it considered the property of the shliach, and in that case, any gain is credited. The shliach will be the only one who gets any increase in value of the produce. So now in that connection, Tana Rabbanan, halakech sada b'shem chaveri, if somebody buys a field in somebody else's name, in kofed nosa limko, we don't force him to sell. So who's the him? What do we mean to force him to sell? That's what the Gemara is going to deal with. We don't know yet. All we know is let's just look at the words of the Braisa. Then the Gemara is going to start talking about what does the Braisa mean. Halakech sada b'shem chaveri, so far all we know is Ruvain is buying a field from Shimon, saying that he's buying it in Levi's name. En kofen oisei limko. We don't force him to sell. Who is the him? We don't know yet. V'im omale amana. But if he said, on condition, kofen oisei limko, then we do force him to sell. My karma. So what does that braisa mean? Amar Rav Sheshes hachakama. The braisa means like this. Now, what logical reason might there be when you're buying a field to claim that you're buying it on behalf of somebody else? Well, one reason might be that you're claiming that you're buying it on behalf of you're buying it as a shliach of somebody powerful. That way, it's less likely that other people are going to go and say, hey, you know, we have reason, you know, we're going to file claims in Beis Din claiming that this property is ours. They may not want to start up with it. So that's exactly it. If somebody buys a field from somebody else in the name of the Reish Kalusa, now really what he means is exactly that. He's not really buying it on behalf of the Reish Kalusa. He's just doing it. He doesn't want, Rashi says, Shalo Yetsu Ala Asikin. You don't want people to start filing suits in Beis Din. Hey, this field is really mine. They'll be afraid of the Reish Kalusa. They'd be afraid to start up with him. In this case, so what happened now? Well, that's the problem is, we're going to talk about it, may backfire. That's that way. The point is, now, so the seller wrote out the document saying, I'm fine, I'm selling this field to the Reish Kalusa. What it means is, Ein kofen oisei Reish Kalusa limker. We cannot force the Reish Kalusa to go and sell, meaning to write a document that he's actually selling it to the lekeach. So therefore, in other words, you, the list, kind of backfires. You, the lekeach, thought that you're being smart. No, if you thought you're being smart, you're protecting your purchase by this way people will think you're buying it on behalf of the Reish Kalusa and they won't start up with you. Meanwhile, though, you don't have a document showing that it's yours. The document shows that it belongs to the Reish Kalusa. What to prevent him from taking it? V'im Omer Amanas, but if he said that I'm buying it on condition that such a document be written, kofen es Reish Kalusa limko, then we would force the Reish Kalusa to sell, meaning in other words to write out a document that I'm transferring ownership from me to you. That's what we're saying. But so wait, Omar. So now we're going to analyze that in light of what we learned before about the case of Ashliya. So Omar. So let's the Braisa said, or not really the Braisa hadn't said explicitly, but Sheshet explained the Braisa to be saying, Halakeach sada b'shem Reish Kalusa, ein kofen oisei Reish Kalusa limker. Miklal d'mikni akanyalei. What's the implication is that he actually has acquired it.
If you say that you're buying on...
Well, in other words, the implication of the fact that we're saying we don't force the Reish Kalusa to sell, the implication is the Reish Kalusa at this point is effectively considered the owner of the property.
Yeah.
Because when the mocher sold it, you need the das of the mocher to be maknet. He thought you're buying it on behalf of the Reish Kalusa. Therefore, that's who he intended to be koneh.
Yes.
The problem with that is lema pliga d'bnei marav. In that case, do we have to say that this braisa, or at least Rav Sheshes' explanation of it, disagrees with the bnei marav? Yesterday, in the course of the discussion, we mentioned that. Rabbi Yochanan had argued that if you didn't do a shinui, if you bought exactly what you were told to buy, then how does the mocher know that you're buying it on behalf of the person who provided the money? He doesn't know that there's that person standing behind you. He knows you're coming to his store to buy the wheat. We're assuming he doesn't know. How is he supposed to be machmeh? That's the B'nai Ma'arav had said. It sounds like Rav Sheshis is disagreeing with that. He's saying even though the mocher doesn't necessarily know that the mocher doesn't necessarily know that you're standing in on behalf of the Reish Kavosa, that you're claiming to be standing on behalf of the Reish Kavosa, nevertheless he's being machmeh to him.
Meaning who? The person
who's selling the field. Who's selling the field. So according to them, unless that person knows, he has no way of being machmeh to the Baal HaBayis. But it sounds like over here, even without him knowing, he'll be machmeh to the Baal HaBayis. In this case, being the Reish Kavosa. Yeah. There are, by the way, achronim who want to learn that when the Gemara said Mekfal Demitni Akanya lay means the person who's actually buying it, not the Reish Kavosa, who's really a fictitious partner over here, but rather that the person himself was providing the money. And then in that case, the question is similar. Given that the mocher thinks you're buying on behalf of the Reish Kavosa, how is he supposed to be machmeh to you? Okay. Anyway, the Gemara says, Imishum ho lekasha. Well, it's tonight. That's the next part of the Braita. If you made it tonight, sure. But we're saying if you didn't make it tonight. So the answer is Imishum ho lekasha. If that's what you're asking, that's not such a serious question. Because the case could be that not only you informed the owner of the field that you said I'm buying it on behalf of the Reish Kavosa. You're coming and saying I'm buying it on behalf of the Reish Kavosa, write a document like that. But suppose you actually inform him and you inform the Edim that no, I'm actually buying it for myself. I'm only mentioning the Reish Kavosa because I want a fictitious document written like that in order to scare off any potential objectors. So then he obviously knows who's really buying it. The problem with that is Ella Ema Seifa. Fine, but in that case, let's look at the next part of the Braisa. Almanas Koifenotz Reish Kavosa Limker. We said that if he buys it, the problem with Rav Sheshis' explanation, then fine. You can say Rav Sheshis' explanation doesn't necessarily disagree with B'nai Ma'arav. However, we have a problem. We say that the mocher has to know who he's actually selling to. Not that it's the agent, that it's the shliach who's doing the buying.
But it sounds like that.
Right. In order for the Baal HaMos, in order for the Meshaleach to be koneh. Yeah. Ela Ema Seifa. But let's look at the next part of the Braisa. The real problem with Rav Sheshis' explanation is look at the next part of the Braisa. Almanas, we said if you're buying it, almanas, that a proper document should be written, kofinoisa reish kolosa limka, then we can force the reish kolosa to resell it, meaning to write out such a document. I'm mine. Now, why should the Reish Kavosa be on the hook to do anything? Let the Reish Kavosa said, why'd you involve me in the first place? You wanted to use my name, my authority, you wanted to honor me, like you're buying it on my behalf. Now, in the end, though, I don't want that, and I don't want you zilu saichu. I don't want you treating me like a commoner, like as if I'm a person who has to sell their fields. Because usually, when you sell a field, is when you're desperate for money. I don't want to be involved in the whole thing just because you made it tonight with the guy who sold you the field. Why does that put me on the hook to write anything? I don't want people to look and say, hey, there's a document that Reish Kavosa sold his fields. He must be doing badly financially. What do I need all that for? Elam Rabbi says no. Rather, here's the explanation of the Braisa. Halakeach sada b'shem chaveri Reish Kavosa. If somebody buys a field in the name of his friend, who is the Reish Kavosa, so Rashi takes gerdus the word Reish Kavosa. On the side of here, it mentions that the Rosh is not gerdus it, because the truth is for purposes of what we're talking about over here at this point, it's not necessarily important whether the third party is the Reish Kavosa or not. It could be the same. I mean, practically speaking, you would have, like Rashi said before, you usually would try to do this kind of thing by bringing in the name of the Reish Kavosa in order to scare off potential claimants. It doesn't necessarily have to be a Reish Kavosa, though, per se.
But,
whatever the case, yeah. So, what happens is, when we say we can't force, it means we can't force the seller to write another document out to say. So if he told him I'm a nas, then you can force him. Then you can force him to. I only bought the field on condition that eventually I will get a deed that says that this field belongs to me. Temporarily, I wanted to get one that has the Reish Kabbalah's name on it in order to scare off any potential claimants. But I'm doing it. I'm only buying it. I'm a nas that you will eventually write me a proper document. So if he said, I'm a nas, fine. But if he didn't, you can't force the seller to bother writing out another document. Without saying I'm a nas, right. And the point is, basically, because it would be a bother for him to have to write out another document. You can't say it's kofin. Yeah, well, it costs money, but also it looks bad for him. Like, I had to sell the same field a bunch of times. So the Rosh explains that that's why you can't say it's kofin amidas daim. Why don't you say, look, I'm gaining from it, you're not losing anything, because you could argue I am losing it. It ruins my credit, basically. Okay, Omar.
He's selling
to one person, and now he's selling it to another person. Yeah, okay. It looks bad, though. It looks odd. It looks like he's not trustworthy. Whatever. Okay, Omar. So now let's analyze the Braisa in terms of the way Abaya learned it. So the question is pshita. Well, of course you can't force him to. Why would you? Without a tanai, if the buyer didn't bother making such a tanai. Of course, he messed things up for himself. Why would you think that the mocher has to help him with that? The answer is ma'ur detema mati omalei, because you would think, if not for the blighter saying so, maybe the buyer should be able to say to the seller, maybe yadit danol nafshoi shakilna, you know perfectly well that I was buying this field only for myself. All I wanted is a panchia. Panchia, Rashi says, means something to strengthen it. So I was just doing it in order to strengthen my position. You know perfectly well I wasn't going to throw away my money for nothing. I only bought this field having in mind, even without an explicit tanai. You would think it would be considered as if it was, even though it's not explicit, you would think as if it's implied that there's going to be a tanai, that you're going to write me another shtar. Kamash Malon, the chiddush is therefore the braisa, that we don't say that. Because the seller can tell him right back, look, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, you had a tanai with the person that you bought it in his name. That he should write you another shtar. In other words, so yeah, you can't argue that I know you're not gonna throw away your money for nothing. But without you making a tanai with me, I didn't know that you intend to put me on the hook to write another shtar. You could have been putting him on the hook. You could have had a tanai ahead of time with him, the Reish Galusa or whatever, that you're going to buy it and use his name to scare off any potential claimants, and then you'll make a tanai. The tanai is that afterwards he'll write you a good shtar. Without a tanai with me, I don't know. There's no reason to obligate me any more than him. And therefore, that's the point.
And therefore,
the guy is kind of caught between two stools. He didn't make a tanai with the seller. He didn't make a tanai with the Reish Kabbalah. Therefore, he can't really force either of them. He can't force the seller, because the seller can argue, you didn't make a tanai with me, so I'm not supposed to know what kind of tanai you made with anybody else. The Reish Kabbalah can say, like we said before, I don't need you to honor me. I don't need you to degrade me. And therefore, he got stuck in. As opposed to, if it was a tanai, then fine. A tanai is a tanai. No, not necessarily. It could be, as we said before, it could be even that he informed the seller and the agent. As long as it was a verbal tanai, yeah. I mean, if there's a question whether it was verbal tanai, you'll deal with it like any other case where there's a difference of opinion between people. You'll go to Beis Din and there'll be oaths or whatever. Yeah. Okay. The second, and then the Braisa.
In other words, conclusion: don't do that.
Don't do it without a tanai. Yeah. Then we continue in the Braisa that if he said that I'm buying this on condition that you write such a document, then you can force the seller to sell it, meaning to rewrite, to write a new document. Again, the question is pshito. Well, obviously, if he made a tanai, then that's binding. The answer is loy tzricha de omelo lasade kamedi day. Suppose that he told that it's not necessary to say it only in a case as follows. He says to the Edim, He says to the edim in front of him, the buyer says to the edim in front of the seller, Chazu de shtar achrin akabaina. Look to see that I want another shtar. So he didn't explicitly speak to the moicher, but he spoke to the edim in the presence of the moicher that I'm doing this intending to get another shtar. Well, that's the point. You would think maybe the seller can say, well, you're telling the agent you intend to get another star. Maybe you meant you intend to get another star from that third party, from the Reish Galusa. Therefore, the Chiddush is, the reason why I went to the trouble of telling the agent while you're present is the Minachu de Kabaina, because it's from you that I intend to get that star. So even though I didn't explicitly make a tenai with you, but since I told the edim in your presence that I'm buying this field intending to get another shtar, then I meant that to be binding on you. I don't need to make an explicit tenai with you.
That's not enough to have him bound by
that's what the Braita is saying that it is. It's considered
without consent?
To that extent, it's considered, if he disagrees, then he doesn't have to sell the field.
In other words, if he stays quiet, then
if he stays quiet, then it's fine. Yeah, if he were to object and say, I don't accept this thing, that's different. Yeah.
Right.
Another case involving one person buying something on behalf of another. Rav Kahana Yoiv Zuza Kitna. Rav Kahana one time gave money to a seller in order to buy flax. At this point, the Gemara is assuming that he did a kinyan on the flax. He didn't pick it up yet. He did a kinyan on it, but he left it still in the possession of the seller. Because he didn't need it yet in his own warehouses or whatever. Well, Sophie Yaakov Kitna, later on the price of flax went up. Zabne Marvase de Kitna, and the owner of the flax sold it, intending to go and give the money to Rav Kahana. Also, came to Rav. So Rav Kahana came to Rav to ask a shaila. Amalei my Eved. So what should I do in this case? Is there a potential problem of ribis? Azel Eshkel Zuzoi, should I go take my money? Or is there a possibility of ribis? Because originally I paid X amount, and now they're paying me, and now they're giving me a larger amount.
So the case again is?
He had bought the flax for $100. Now it's worth $150. So the guy sold it for $150 and is going to be giving him that money. We're assuming, again, the original assumption is that the flax actually belonged to Rav Kahana, and he was leaving it as a deposit by this guy, and this guy went and sold it. Maybe. But in this case, it went up. If it went down, though, there wouldn't be an issue of ribis. The problem of ribis comes into play because it goes up. Well, that's what we're going to be discussing. The question basically is who was considered the owner of the flax at this point? So wait, Amalei. So Rav tells him, if when they sell this flax, Amri, they say Hai Kitna to Kahanahu, that this flax belongs to Kahana, meaning it's accepted that it is your property, and they're just selling it on your behalf. Zil shkoil, then gezunt dehet. You can take the money because there's no ribis involved over here. You had property which was a deposit by them. They sold it on your behalf. Fine. There's no ribis involved. There was no loan and there was not only a loan. I mean, midaraisa ribis only applies to loans. Midrabanan it also applies in various cases as we're going to talk about briefly over here, and we'll learn much more in Bava Matiyah in a few months' time. As the Shem, we'll learn much more that midrabanan there are cases of ribis that apply to sales as well. Basically, when you're selling something, it's actually in Rambam Shlosh Prakim these days as well. When you're selling something, and for example, you're giving the person a discount because he's paying you ahead of time, or different scenarios of that sort, where you paid X and you're receiving goods worth Y because the guy was paid ahead of time.
The goods are going up in price.
But it's similar. It's a similar concept, though. If this flax
wasn't expected.
Wait. No, it doesn't matter. Midaraisa, what's called ribis tzutza, is only if you made up at the time of the loan that I'm going to pay extra. Midrabanan, there's all kinds of cases where if you end up even if it's unexpected, if you end up getting paid more or getting more goods than you were originally expecting to, then there can be issues of ribis involved. When we learn Perek Ezo Neshech, we'll break our head.
Never resell something.
No, of course you can resell something because it belonged to you. If you buy something for X amount, of course you can resell it for a higher amount. We're not talking about that.
It's also ribis.
No, because ribis involves when there's two parties over here. When you yourself bought something, you're the one party involved. Now when you're reselling it at a higher price, there's no ribis involved. We're dealing over
Someone
here.
Someone wants to buy a car, and I buy the car at a certain price, and I sell it at an added price. Then
That's not ribis. Because ribis is called agar neter. And again, we'll talk about it a lot in Bava Metzia, but it's called agar neter. It's when you're getting paid in some extra money or goods or whatever for the fact that you allowed the other person to have the money in advance. You paid him in advance, and therefore now because of that he's giving you an extra amount or he's giving you a discount or what have you. That's the essence of ribis d'rabbanan.
When you get the money in advance.
When you give the other person the money in advance, and now because of that he's giving you more goods than you would have otherwise gotten. Again, when we learn about it in Ezer Neshach, we'll learn in great detail about it. We'll break our heads over it then, Ben Sashem. For right now, the point is, Rav tells him, if it's clear that this flax belonged to you all this time, zil shkil, then you can go ahead and take the extra money. There's no ribis involved, because there was never any goods of yours that you gave to somebody, or any money of yours that you gave to somebody ahead of time, where now you can say they're giving you more in return for that. The eloi, but if not, loy tishkil, then you should not take that extra money.
Eloi meaning
if they didn't sell it as Rav Kahana's flax, effectively then what it means is that you sort of sold it to them ahead of time at a cheaper price, and therefore they benefited from the fact that they got a cheaper price at the time, and now in return they're giving you a higher price later on. That creates issues of ribbon. Okay. So now relating that to our sugi over here. The question is, Kaman Kibnei Ma'arava. Who would this be like? This statement of Rav, on the face of it, would it be like Bnei Ma'arava? Da'amri, mihadiyah l'bal chitin, shiyak l'chitin l'bal amos. What did the Bnei Ma'arava say again? That you need the person who's selling to know who he's selling to. Remember, again, Rav Kahana, this flax belongs to Rav Kahana. At this point, we're assuming he actually made a kinyan on it. But when it's being sold, it's not known that it was actually his flax. So Rav is saying there could be a scenario when they thought it was someone else's flax. They thought it belonged to the person that it was on deposit by. Well, in that case, that's not the same thing as Bnei Ma'arava are talking about. Otu miyoy Rav Kahana arba v'shokol tamni. What is it? Are we talking about a case where Rav Kahana originally, let's say, paid four for it, and now he's getting eight? How can there be ribis involved? Kitnim emelahu deyakar. The flax went up in value on its own. It was his flax all the time. Whether they knew it was his flax or not, if they didn't know it was his flax, fine. They can be considered gazlonim. Kol gazlonim meshalim kishasak zela. They should have to pay how much. Regardless, I mean, the point is that at the time when they took it to sell it, if they didn't know that it was his, that's zela. As we said, a gazlan has to pay according to the value of the thing when it was stolen. At the time it was stolen, it's already worth eight. Where is there a potential problem of ribis over here? Ribis comes into play when you have buying and selling. Not when you have, for example, that in this case they took his flax and sold it thinking that it was theirs.
Give us an example of the same case where there would be ribis.
That's what we're talking about over here. If he had, for example, sold it to them at a cheaper price at the beginning, And now when it goes up in price, they sell it to somebody else at the higher price and give him the higher price. That would be a problem of ribis, because they're giving him a higher price. They're doing him a favor and giving him extra because he lent them money or sold them goods at a discount earlier on. But in this case, it wasn't like that. He never sold it to them. Migzal gazur. They stole it. Utsnan kol gazlon and mesham and kishas akzela. So why is there even any potential problem of ribis over here? What is Rav Kahana asking, and what is Rav telling him? Amri, so the answer no. You have the situation wrong. It wasn't that it wasn't that Rav Kahana had actually acquired the flax at the time. Hasam Amona Havoi. What happened over there? There was an Amona. Amona means basically you trust the other person. He gave them money ahead of time. They didn't yet have flax to sell him, but he gave them money ahead of time so that when you have flax, then I'm locking in the price now. So in other words, he had paid originally four zuzim or whatever it is for this flax, but not that there was actual flax there for him to do a kinyan on. He just paid ahead of time for it.
So he didn't pay.
He advanced the money so that when flax is available in the marketplace, when you have flax to sell, I've locked in the price ahead of time at four zuz for a bundle, even though later on it might be worth six to eight or what have you. And in fact, by the time flax was available, the price had gone up to eight per bundle.
They bought it for him at four.
So Rav Kahana had never done any meshicha on this flax. So why is Rav telling him that if the flax was never considered to be yours, is it a problem? V'Rav l'taymei. Rav is going according to his own shita. D'omer Rav, oisin amona b'peres vein oisin amona b'damin. This kind of amona works when it comes to produce. You can, for example, there's a concept in halacha called, in connection with these things of locking in the price ahead of time, there's a concept called yotz ha'shar. If there's a known prevailing price for this kind of goods, then you're allowed to make deals and say, I want to lock in the price now. And later on, the price goes up, meaning that you're going to get more for your money. Not a problem with business, because we say alpha pisha ein lozeh yesh lozeh. Once there's a prevailing price, you yourself may not have flax at that time, but somebody else does. In theory, let's say Rav gives right now four zuzim in order to lock in the price on a bundle of flax. Right now, the guy he's buying from doesn't happen to have any flax. However, because the prevailing price right now is four zuzim for a bundle, that guy could just as well go to somebody else and buy it at four for a bundle and give it to Rav Kahana. He doesn't. Fine. He's waiting until his own flax grows and is processed and whatever. That's fine. By the time he grows and processes and whatever, his flax has gone up to eight. Not a problem of ribbon. Because he could have bought flax at the time at four zuz in the bundle and given it to the farmer. However, Rav says that works as far as produce, but that doesn't work as far as money. Which is a machlokes in Bava Metzia between Rav and I think Rav Yanai over there. So in this case, for example, what are we talking about? We're not talking about the person giving him flax. We're talking about him giving him money. That now he's going to give him eight zuzim instead of four. Rav holds that would be a problem. So if the flax actually belonged to Rav Kahana, if when they sold it they knew it's Kahana's flax, meaning you had already done a kinyan on it, sure, there's no problem with ribbis in that case. If it's your flax, you're entitled to sell it at a profit or to have an agent sell it for you at a profit. The problem would be you never actually owned this flax because all you did is you put down money on it, but you never did meshicha or anything on it. Now, by the time his flax is available, it's selling for eight zuz a bundle,
right,
and he's actually selling it then and giving you the eight zuz, that creates a problem of ribbis because now, effectively, what he's doing is it amounts to he's giving you extra because you did him the favor, because you helped him out by giving him the four zuz ahead of time. Because he had your four zuz available all this time to invest or whatever, therefore now he's returning you eight. That's a problem. That's the ribbis d'rabbanan.
You gave him money to buy
the flax. At the time, it's true, he could have just gone and bought flax and gave it to you.
But he didn't.
So fine, if later on he has his own flax and he gives you that flax, that's not a problem. Even though the flax is now worth eight. But if he sells that flax to a third party and gives you the money, where now he's giving you eight, where you originally gave him four, then you got ribbit. That's what Rav is telling Rav Kahana. Well, it's machlokas in Bava Metzia, whether Daraisa Meshicha is Kona, or whether Rav Yerchan says Daraisa is Kona, that the Daraisa is the exchange of money. Well, there wasn't any flax yet then. The guy didn't have the flax yet. In a sense, it was a double shalai bolo.
So ribbis is, you cannot sell something that you don't possess?
That's a different thing. But in order for it to be a problem of ribbis, it would have to be but it would have to be two things. There'd have to be two conditions. Number one, in terms of our Gemara, what's important is that the guy didn't have flax yet at the time, and that later on he's not giving you the actual flax that you bought, but rather he's giving you money that he sold it for. That's what creates the problem. If it were to be, that he gave you the actual flax, as long as one or the other is true, as long as either there was the known price at the time was 4 zuz, which is what you paid, or that he actually had flax at the time, either that would be fine if later on he only gives it to you later on when the price goes up. Either it's called Yotza Hashar or Yeshlai. Those are the two conditions under which it's allowed.
It amounts to the same thing.
No, it doesn't, because one you're giving him flax and the other one you're giving him money.
Yeah, but he could resell the flax.
That's fine. He could resell the flax. The fact of the matter is that when you're giving him money, it looks more like ribis, that you're giving him twice as much money or whatever percentage more money than he gave you. As opposed to when you give him flax, okay, the fact of the matter is he could have bought flax at that time and given it to you, which would have been worth 4. And at that point, so going up from 4 to 8 would have all been once it's in your possession after the sale was already done. That's the difference.
So he could go buy flax and give him flax.
He could at the time. Yeah. When Rav gives him the 4, yeah, he could. When Rav gives him the 4, he could right away go buy a bundle of flax.
No, not now, after the price went up.
Oh, after the price went up, he'll have to buy it for 8. But yeah, I mean, that's the point. The reason why it's allowed is because at the time already Yotza Hashar, there was already a prevailing price, meaning there was already flax on the market being sold at 4 zuz. He could have at that point bought a bundle and given it to Rav Kahana. So even though he didn't, even though he waited until his own flax was ready, and by that time it was 8, that's not a problem. Yeah, we're talking about what Rashi says, Yotza Hashar. Yeah. Again, when we get to this, Yotza Hashar means there's a prevailing price. There's a known fixed price for this thing in the market that'll last for at least the season or whatever. Yeah. Again, in a few months' time, we'll be breaking our heads over this in Bava Metzia. Don't you worry. Okay. Mishnah says, "Hagozel of chaveda shava prutas." Okay, so basically, from here until the end of the parak, basically, we're going to be switching gears a little bit. We're still talking about zela, but we're going to be talking about the bein adam lamakom angle on zela. The Torah tells us in two places. One is at the end of Parshas Vayikra. The other one is in the middle of Parshas Bamidbar. That if a person steals, you have a mitzvah of zela. That's a given. But if a person also swears falsely on it, he's taken to Beis Din and swears falsely, and doesn't have the thing, then other rules apply. Then he has to pay the actual amount. He has to pay to the nigzol. He has to pay an additional chomesh, 25%, and he has to bring a korban asham. So from here till the end of the parak, we're going to be dealing with all the different angles on those. Well, then it's enough. I mean, he has to also ask the chilah from the guy like we lived in Achogel, but yeah. So the Mishnah starts off. Hagozel chaveda shava prota v'nishvala. If somebody steals from somebody else, even as little as a shava prota, and then he swears falsely to him that he didn't steal it, later on he does tshuva and admits that he did steal it. Yelechenu achra v'madai. Then at that point, the only way for him to get his kapara is to go and actually give it to the guy in person, even if it means going as far as madai. Madai is in Iran nowadays, so to go from Eretz Yisrael to there would be a considerable distance. And, you know, in modern terms, it would be like to say, you know, I mean, you're going to follow him to New Zealand or something, you know.
Yeah, right.
Because if there hadn't been a shavua involved, then it would be enough that you hold on to the thing. And when the guy comes to get it from you, then fine. But because like this, you have to go after him a Madai. There's a verse, by the way, that's a verse from the Vilna Gaon. There's a verse from the Vilna Gaon that says there's a pasuk in Yeshaya that refers to Madai as a very rich country. Yeah, so therefore the point is that a pruta would be worth less than nothing. Even then, even if the guy is in Madai though, and a pruta there, what's worth a pruta in Eretz Yisrael is worth next to nothing over there, you still have to go and then schlep over there to give it to him. Hey, Mishnah continues, Lo yitin lo levnov lo levshluchoi, you can't give it to the Nigzol's son or his shliach, in the sense that Rashi says that, let's say, for example, you did give it to them, and then, okay, so they're supposed to bring it to their father or their shaleach or whatever, but what if it happens on the way, it gets stolen from them? You still have not been accomplished. You have not accomplished
him. Even if his son is a shliach?
That's the point. Even though he's, you have to give it to him himself. Once you give it to him himself, to the nigzol himself, if it gets stolen from him, that's it. It's not your problem. Doesn't matter. In this case, no. The reason we'll learn in the Gemara, but Rashi mentions on the pasuk the reason is because the pasuk says la'asher hu lo yitnenu. You have to give it to the one to whom it belongs.
You cannot say the shliach is lo
yitnenu. No, but it's not. It's not the same person. It's an interesting, if you look in Chavis Zayin, there's a long sikha where it ever analyzes the Zashi, and it's one of the Uri Yashi sikhas, where it ever analyzes this whole Indian in great detail. Anyway. But you can give the money to a shliach beisdin. Rashi understands that to be, it's a matter of takana sashovim. We'll learn on Amud Beis that Rabbanan made a takana to make it easier for a person to do tshuva. Instead of making him schlep all the way to Modai, he can give it to a shliach beisdin. Meaning, in other words, so Rashi, in other words, Tosfos explains that Rashi evidently means you give it to the shliach beisdin, and when the nigzol comes back from Modai, the shliach beisdin will give it to him. Tosfos learns differently, that rather what it is that we're not even talking about the takana. Once you give it to the shliach beisdin, at that point you have your kapara. You're discharged. You don't even have to wait until the nigzol receives it. So it's not a matter of a takana to bring your korban, because we'll learn later on in the Torah, you can't bring your korban until you've paid back the nigzol. The Eved doesn't want your korban as long as the stolen object is still in your possession.
It's not. It's in the beis din.
That's the point. In other words, that's what Tosfos is saying. Once you give it to the shliach beisdin, then you're good.
What about taking it to
Madai? At that point, that's the thing. You don't have to take it to Madai, but we'll learn on Amud Beis. We'll learn more about this. The Imes Yachzu L'Yoshev, if the Nigzol died, then you give it to his heirs. So then here's the mission. What if you paid the Nigzol, the Keren, the actual amount you stole, but not the Chaymesh? Or suppose the Nigzol forgave you, was Mochel to you, the Keren, but not the Chaymesh? Or he forgave it all, he was mocha it all, except for less than a shavah prutah's worth of the keren. In all those cases, you don't have to go after him to Madai. At that point, you can just hold on to the chomesh or to the less than a prutah of the keren or whatever it is until the guy shows up and then takes it.
Right.
You don't have to, even is the point. You don't even have to go to Beis Din to do it. So you can even, not keep it yourself. You hold on to it at four so that when the Nigzol comes, you'll give it to him. So it's the Keren, that's what we're saying, you have to go after him into Madai. But the Chomesh, you don't have to.
Normally the Chomesh goes to who?
The Chomesh goes to the Nigzol.
To the Nigzol.
Not unless a Chomesh for not unless a Keren. What about the other way around? What if he paid him the Chomesh but not the Keren? Machalai la Chomesh for Machalai la Keren, or the Nigzol was mochel on receiving the chomesh, but not mochel on the keren, or mochel al zev al zev put the shavah prutah the keren, or he was mochel on everything except for a full shavah prutah. Then sarach leil chachva. Then you still have to follow him to Madai and give it to him. Once you have a prutah left of the keren, then that's still enough to. And before we talk about the reason why the Mishnah seems to be repeating itself, it's talking about the first scenario. It's talking about you stole more than a prutah, let's say. And the first case is talking about you stole more than a prutah. And this case is talking about, let's say, you only stole a prutah to begin with. In both cases, or the other way around, whatever. Then in all cases, as long as it's a prutah of stolen goods, you have to go after him even tomorrow. If
there's
like that's what the Mishnah said, you know. Continues the Mishnah. What happens if he paid him the keren, but then falsely swore? Now again, let's say, so in other words like this. He originally stole from him a certain amount. He went to Beis Din, he stole that he didn't. He swore that he didn't. Later on, he's doing shuvah on it. He pays back the keren, and now he's supposed to pay a chomesh as well. Now what happens? He swears falsely that he paid the chomesh, when really he didn't.
After he swore that he...
Yes, after he... So, okay, he stole 100. He stole 100. They go to Beis Din, he says, he swears I didn't steal the 100. Later on, he does shuvah and returns the 100. So the nigzol says, well, you're supposed to be giving me another 25 as well. He says, I swear I already gave you 25. Well, he didn't. What happens is, that chomesh becomes a new keren. So now, eventually, when he does tshuva on that, he's going to have to pay 25 plus another 6 1/4.
Six and a quarter.
One chomesh on top of another. Another karmen asham also, I guess, yeah. Achi yismai ta keren mishavah prota, until you reach the point where the keren itself is less than a shavah prota. The chen b'pikot, Rashi points out on the pasuk, I think we're going to have it in the Gemara later, that we learn it from the fact that the pasuk is v'hamishi sov, which means it's fifth plural, in the sense that there can be several, there can be a fifth of a fifth of a fifth, etc., going down the line. The chen b'pikot, and all of this is true not only of a gzela, where you actually stole the thing, it also is true if the money was originally a pikodin, and then you're falsely claiming that you don't have it, or it was stolen, or what have you. Yes. Shenemar, it says in the pasuk, over pikadon, over sumas yod, over gozel, whether it's a pikadon, whether it's something that was invested in, that was given into his hand, which actually says means a loan, over gozel, or theft, or he held back money that he owes somebody else, like for a job or whatever that he didn't pay him. He found a lost object, and he denies it, and he swears falsely. In all those cases, the point is, so the Gemara starts off. Nishba loy ein loy nishba loy loy. The implication of the Mishnah is that only if he swore falsely do you make him go all the way to Madai to return it. But if there was no shvuah involved, you don't make him go find the person. He can hold on to it or give it into Beis Din until the guy shows up. Mani. Now the question is, who is that? Who is our Mishnah like then? Loy Rab Taifin or Loy Rab Akiva? Our Mishnah then seems to be neither like Rab Taifin nor like Rab Akiva. The Tanya, as we learn a Braisa. Gozol echad mechamisha. If somebody stole from one of five people, the five doesn't definitely mean five. It's the Gemara's indefinite. No, it's just one of the Gemara's indefinite numbers. So he stole from one of a group of people. The any day is man. He doesn't know which one he stole from. Each one is saying he stole from me. Maniach zela by name or mistalek. So Rab Taifin says, well, we don't know though which one is the liar. Could be a mistake. Yeah. Could be each one of them, you never know. I mean, each one of them might have at some point or other been held up and had money stolen from them. And each, they go to the police lineup, and each one wrongly identifies him, So you can put the stolen thing between them and then leave, and he doesn't have any further obligation. Tosfos explains doesn't literally mean Beneihem. It doesn't mean in the sense that they were going to divide it or fight over it or whatever. Beneihem really means that he sets it aside until we can figure out who the real owner is. The different Meparshim talk about, does Reb Taifin mean that you keep it in your own possession until it's figured out, or does it mean you deposit it with Beis Din?
No,
this isn't one of those cases called Alan Gvar. No, that would be there's other cases of that when each one is toying tiny body, whatever. No, not in this case. That difference, by the way, whether we're talking about whether Yaniach mean Maniach Zela Benehem, whether it means that he holds on to it himself or whether it means that he puts it in Beis Din, that affects the understanding of the rest of the sugya. And how you understand Rav Taifin's opinion. Anyway, different Rav Taifin, Rav Akiva Oymer Loizu Derech Metziata Medei Aveda. That's not the way that's going to get him out of the Aveda that he has in his, that he has to do Shuvah for. Hold on to it until the real owner is found, or put it in Beis Din, as the case may be. Ad Sheyashalem Zeh L'Cholach HaVachad. He has to actually pay to each one of them. So, now, given that machloikas, money. So who does our Mishnah going like? Where our Mishnah implies that if there was no Shavuah, which is true in that Braisa, then you don't have to schlep out to Modai to return it to the guy. Erev Taifin, if it's appointed of Taifin, again, the Braisa didn't say anything about swearing or not. It sounds like Rav Taifin doesn't make a distinction. Afagabdi Ishtaba, Amo Maniach Zeleba Neim Mistalik, sounds like even if it swore falsely, all he has to do is just put the Zela down and leave. He doesn't have to actually go figure out who the real owner is. Well, there is going to be a Korban Hashem, but according to Rav Taifin, that's the point. Once he's Maniach Zeleba Beneihem, then fine, he's clear of that. He's gotten it out of his possession. Now he can go bring a Korban Hashem. But he doesn't have to bring it after him to Madai.
He's a
Sofer.
What do you mean?
But that's not the point. In that case, you should have to find. You should have to figure out who the real guy was,
What's a
suffix? In this case, it's a suffix because only one of the five people was the one who you stole from.
It's a mother that you stole.
Right, no, but you don't know from which one. Okay.
Your mother, the guy.
Yeah, okay, fine.
They know.
Yeah, but that's not the distinction, though, because it's true. But over here also, it would be his responsibility. If you were to say it, Taifin is the author of our Mishnah, you would say it's his responsibility to find out which of the five people is the right one. So it doesn't work according to Taifin because then there's no difference between Shavua and not. And according to Rav Akiva, the other way around, regardless of Shavua or not, you're obligated to pay each one individually. It sounds like that according to Rav Taifin, even if you didn't swear, you're going to have to follow the guy to Madai to return the money. So our Mishnah Rav Akiva doesn't seem to make that distinction either.
That
either way, you'd have to return it. So you're not potter until you for sure return to the person that you stole from. And if there's five different people, it means you're going to have to pay it out five times. But our Mishnah, which implies that only our Mishnah, which says that if you swore falsely, you have to bring it to Madai, implying, but if you didn't swear falsely, you don't need to, that seems to agree with neither Rav Taifa nor Rav Akiva. The answer is La'ulam Rav Akiva. You could say that our Mishnah is, in fact, according to Rav Akiva. But V'chi ka'amar Rav Akiva ad she'shalom zeh l'chol ha'chavecha? No, because when does Rav Akiva say that you have to pay each one individually? Hecha de'shtabah hu'kama. Itaka means only when you swore. He would have to agree with Rav Taifa that if you hadn't sworn falsely, you could just maniach zeh l'benehem. So that's exactly what our Mishnah is implying.
So what's the difference between
my timer? So what's the reason? Why would Rabbi Akiva make that distinction? Because the pasuk says, in connection with the false shavua, to the one to whom it belongs to, you have to give on the day when you admit your guilt. But only when you're dealing with a shavua, which is what the Torah is talking about over there, are you actually obligated to give it to the guy, meaning to bring it to Madai or to pay each of the five people or whatever. But no shavua, then you don't have that.
Has the Rabbi
Tarfin? Virab Tarfin, whereas Rabbi Tarfin would answer to that, Afagav the Ishtaba, yes, but even though he swore, over it's true, Midaraisa, he should have to go and give it to each one individually, etc. But over Rabbanan Takanta. But he says the Rabbanan made a Takana to say that not, the Takana Tashabim, a Takana to make it easier for the person to do Tshuva. Tanya, wait. No, so in other words, that's the point. So
Akiva doesn't say that Takana.
There are Mephoshim who explain that Rabbi Akiva would disagree with that Takana, but there are other Mephoshim who say that what they're disagreeing, kind of Tosfos talks about, that they're disagreeing on the parameters of the Takana. When does the Takana apply and when does it not? By the way, Tosfos points out, the Gemara would rather shtelein the Mishnah like Rabbi Akiva, because Stam Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Meir was a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva. Generally speaking, we should assume that a Stam Mishnah follows the opinion of Rabbi Akiva unless we have reason to say otherwise. The Rashba says that when the Gemara says the Mishnah means that when the Gemara says the Mishnah can be like Rabbi Akiva, doesn't mean only Rabbi Akiva, means the Mishnah could agree with Rabbi Taufin as well. You could understand Rabbi Taufin's opinion to be in accordance with the Mishnah as well. Anyway, Rabbi Taufin would say there was a Takana, the Tanya of Elazar of Tzadik Vaymer, Takana Gdola Hiskinu, the Chachamim made a great Takana. And it's called Takana Gdola, by the way. One thing Rashi mentioned someplace else, I think in Bava Metzia, that it's called Takana Gdola in the sense this is one of those rare cases where the Chachamim made a Takana that cancels out something D'oraisa. Here we're saying that D'oraisa is going to have to follow the guy to Madai or return it to all the five people or whatever, and that Abanon, Mitzvah, Takana Tashavim, are canceling that out, which they have the ability to do in cases of Dini Mominus. We don't Dini Mominus, they have the ability to do that because Hefka based in Hefka.
Only in
Dini Mominus, right. Well, we said, we learned there, we had a whole story about it, that in other areas of halacha, they can when it's a shev val tase. Only when they're telling you not to, something the Torah tells you to do, and they can tell you you don't have to do it. Like blowing the shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos. They can't tell you to explicitly violate something that's their daraisa. So over here, actually, it could work out either way. I mean, it is shev val tase. Well, no, but it is kind of kum vase, because they can't allow you to bring your korban unless you've accomplished what the Torah tells you to do, to return the Heshem HaZela. But like this, because Hefka based in Hefka, they have the ability to say that the Heshem HaZela has been accomplished. So, the Takana is as follows. Shem Hoysa Hitzah Yuseir Alakeren, if the expenses of returning the stolen thing, of going to Madai or whatever, would be greater than the original amount you stole, Meshalam Keren V'Chomish LeBasin, then you just pay the Keren V'Chomish to... He doesn't know. You give the Keren and the Chomish to Beis Din, or maybe Ashrama and Miskaper, and at that point you can bring your Asham and your good. So therefore, sort of Tyrephan says that, yes, in the case when you have the five people then, even you swore falsely, but in that case, paying all of them back would mean the expenses would be greater than the Keren. You stole 100 and you're going to be paying out 500. Therefore, the Takana de Rabbanan applies. You don't have to do that. You just put the Gzela in Beis Din, you put the Keren and Chomish in Beis Din, and then they bring your Korban and you're good. Where's Rabbi Akiva? Would answer back to that. Fine. It's sort of like what you said about Vadai versus Safik. When would we? I agree there's that Takana de Rabbanan. When would that apply? Only if you know who it was that you stole from. Where after all, at least then, eventually, the money is going to get back to its owner. Fine. Right now, you're giving it to Basin, but Basin's not going to hold on to it permanently. Eventually, the owner is going to come back, and they'll give it to him. But Gazal Echad Mechamisha, but when he stole from one of five people, the Loyavel Aman Gazle, you don't even know which one he stole from. So Lehodel Amamon Lamare, putting it in Basin is not going to help. How is it ever going to get back to the guy? Basin is not going to necessarily have a way of figuring out who the real Nigzo was either. Therefore, Rabbi Akiva would say that the Rabbanan never made the Takana in such a case. In that case, you would actually have to return it to all five of them. You would have to actually give it to all five
people.
If there's five people, you have to give them.
And is it four?
Same thing. Come on. Again, Tosfos talks about, but there may be a further difference between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon. They might be talking about they might be talking about, for example, let's say Rabbi Tarfon. There might actually be in a certain sense there might be a kula in what Rabbi Akiva is saying over Rabbi Tarfon. Namely, suppose, for example, there is no local Beis Din. Fine, you don't have to go all the way to Madai for the guy necessarily, but let's say the nearest Beis Din is 100 miles away. It is going to take some expense to get there. So Rabbi Akiva might hold then you don't even need to do that in that case. It's enough that you just keep it by you until the Nigdal comes back. As opposed to, Reb Tarfon would say you have to bring it to a Beis Din regardless. And if the nearest Beis Din is 100 miles away, fine, you'll have to schlep the 100 miles. It's going to be, the expenses of going that 100 miles are going to be more than the Karen. Doesn't matter. Yeah. Mosiv Reb Huna Bar Yehuda. That's our choice for sons. Mosiv Reb Huna Bar Yehuda. Okay, now, so far we have that explanation, but Reb Huna Bar Yehuda asks on that from another braisa that says, Omer Reb Shimon Ben Elazar, Lo Nechlaku Reb Tarfon Reb Akiva Al Shalaka Chacham Nechamisha. No, Reb Tarfon and Reb Akiva don't disagree about a similar case. If somebody bought something from one of five people, the Eni Adem Ezeman Lachach, he doesn't know which one he bought it from. So each of them is claiming the money. He has the goods, let's say, but each one is claiming...
Wait,
that's what we're going to talk about. Wait. That in that case, all you have to do is you put down the money in front of them, meaning, like we said before, in Beis Din, or maybe in your own possession or whatever, and then you leave. Actually, in that case, Meforshim say it would have to mean in Beis Din, because if you keep it by you, then how are you claiming it? Okay.
That's obvious.
What is the machlokas? If you stole from one of five people, the any adam is meant gozal. You don't know which one you stole from. Now, the point is, the question is, so what are you telling me? In the previous discussion in the Gemara? You're telling me the previous phase of the discussion. You're telling me only if he swore falsely is when Rabbi Akiva is going to say he has to repay all of them, because otherwise he can't bring his offer. If you're talking about that he swore falsely, mali lokach mali gozal. What does it matter whether it was that he bought and claim that he paid when really he didn't, or whether he stole and claimed that he didn't. And either way, if you swear falsely, like the Mishnah said, any case where you have somebody else's mammon in your hand and swears falsely, the same rules apply. The same Karen v'chaimish and Asham apply. So it doesn't work to say then that the first braisa is talking about only when he swore falsely. Because in that case, there'd be no reason to distinguish between buying and stealing. But Oid Masiv Rava, furthermore, Rava points out another contradiction. It happened once that a certain chosid bought from one of two people. He didn't know which one he had bought from. So he came to the Tyrefin to ask what to do. Just put the money down between them, again, in Beis Din or whatever, and then you can leave. That's it. You've been yotze at that point. It'll be up to them to work out between themselves which one was the real seller. But then he came to Rabbi Akiva to ask him what to do. I guess he didn't feel that was enough. If you get a psak le'istu, you can't go to another Rav Lahetur, but you can the other way around. You're masking on yourself. And Rabbi Akiva tells him, no, there's no takana unless you pay each one individually. Now, it means there's no way to fix up the situation. If you want to be yotze, then you're going to have to pay both of them. Now, if you're going to say that the braisa is talking about when he swore falsely, you're calling a chosid swear falsely. Okay, so you might answer, fine, he did tshuva, he swore falsely, later on he did tshuva, and now he's becoming a real chosid. The problem with that is we know that whenever the Gemara tells us that there was a story with a certain chassid, means Oyrab Yehuda ben Bava, Oyrab Yehuda ben Boy, it was one of those two. They're the ones who are called chassid echad. That's they had the Kabbalah. They're the ones who had a special midas chassidus to them. But when it says ma'isa b'chassid echad, it means one of them. They were always chassidim. You can't say that they were that when they were younger they swore falsely and now that they got older they did tshuva. They weren't like that. They were good to begin with. By the way, on this that we're saying that they were chassidim to be ikra, there's an interesting point that a number of mafarshim point out. In that case, the implication is usually yes, you can call a person a chassid even if he was originally a rasha, swore falsely or whatever, and now did tshuva. Only because we know that ma'isa b'chassid echad means one of these two Rabbi Yehudas, then we know it doesn't work in this case. But generally, we could assume the word chassid can include a Baal Shuvah.
But here, the Gemara seems to be...
No, the Gemara is saying that not only because we know that ma'isa b'chassid echad means somebody who was originally a tzaddik, but not necessarily across the board. Now, it's interesting because there's a Rashi in the Sefer Sukkah, the famous thing when it talks about over there, about chassidim ba'anshe ma'isa would dance and sing by Simchas Beit HaSheva, and then the Gemara brings the famous Braisa that the chassidim would say that the hat were happy is our youth, that it didn't embarrass, that we did good then and it didn't embarrass us in our old age. The Baal Teshuva would sing happy is our youth, as our old age, that was mechaper for our youth, and Eilu Ve'Eilu Oimrim, the famous song, Eilu Ve'Eimrim Ashe Mishle Chata, Misha Chata Yashu V'Yim Chaloi. Rashi mentions over there that the definition of chassidim is that they were all, that they were always tzaddikim, as opposed to Baal Teshuva. That seems to contradict our Gemara.
That's right.
So there's a couple of different explanations that various Mepharshim give, but there is actually the Rebbe once talked about it. The Rebbe once pointed out in a sicha that in fact Rashi and the Rambam may disagree on this. Rashi may hold that in fact a chassid means somebody who was always a chassid. Therefore, the Mishnah is telling us what a chassidim do. The Braisa adds another group that's not mentioned in the Mishnah, namely the Baal Teshuva. Whereas the Rambam, based on an analysis of the way the Rambam says it, may hold that no, like our Gemara says, a chassid can include somebody who was a Baal Teshuva, and therefore the Baal Teshuva of the Gemara over there who say Ashri Ziknasenu, etc., are included in the chassidim of the Mishnah.
That's what Rashi
would say that not. A chassid, by definition, has to be somebody who was always a
chassid. So a chassid, according to Rashi, is a veterinary.
So a chassid, in that sense, I guess, yeah. And actually, the Rebbe says, Rashi might understand, or Gemara, to be saying that, fine, as a shema mushal, as a borrowed term, you could call a chassid to be somebody who only became a chassid later in life. The true definition of chassid would be, like the Rebbe says, and then in Tanya, the true definition of a tzaddik, somebody who was always a tzaddik.